Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic. We're here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Nine, the new musical starring Daniel Day-Lewis. And joining me in the studio at Slate is June Thomas. Hi, June.
Hello, Dana.
You are Slate's foreign editor.
That's correct.
And you are also one of my favorite spoiler companions, especially for anything involving a musical and or theater. So you were the perfect one for Nine.
Except that I didn't see the show Nine, nor did I see 8.5. So I fear that my build-up was none deserved today.
Well, we should set up what those are. Eight and a half, right? The Fellini movie, which the title of the show is sort of a joke on. The next step after 8.5 is Nine. Mm-hmm. And Nine was also a Broadway musical that I believe swept the Tonys or did very well at the Tonys in the 80s, early 80s.
Yeah, and then it was revived earlier this decade, 2003, I think, Chita Rivera, it was, you know, Antonio Banderas was Guido.
Why did you not see that revival? That sounds so up your alley.
It was before I lived in New York.
Ah.
Or I probably would have. And you can tell that there's a sort of, what do we call it? It's happened before that an Italian movie became a musical and then was a successful musical movie. Knights of Calabria became Sweet Charity, that then was a successful.
Oh, see, this is why I have June Thomas in these podcasts. I would never have known that.
So that was a successful movie. Of course, that was before we moviegoers.
Wait, Knights of Cabiria, you mean?
Yes,
Knights
of
Cabiria,
yeah,
the Fellini movie,
excuse
right.
Me. Yes.
I was thinking Calabria. Did we have two? Right.
I said that wrong. And so I think, you know, that was the inspiration, I'm guessing, but I think we've changed our movie-going habits since then, and Sweet Charity would have seemed really cool. I'm not sure that America is gasping for Nine. I will even know what it is. It's just, it hasn't entered that level of consciousness.
We were just talking about that. Sweet Charity's from what, the early 60s, right?
Something like that.
With Shirley MacLaine?
Yes.
I need to see that movie.
Yes.
But so that still came from the era when musicals were a normal thing to splash up on the Hollywood screen, right?
Right.
And people bursting into song was something that everybody took for granted. But for whatever reason, that dinosaur kind of became extinct, and now you have to work really hard to make people buy that concept.
Right.
And I wanted to talk about how this movie does it, which, as I gather, I didn't see the stage show either, but I think it's quite different from how the stage show did it.
Yeah. I think it's a compliment that they did this. They were thinking, you know, some movies, some songs you didn't need because the movie establishes whatever they established in song and dance. You know, we see that Guido came from humble beginnings.
Wait, we got to step back and say who Guido is.
Guido is, at this point, the famous Italian film director Guido Contini, who is having trouble making, I guess, his ninth movie. And of course, here's the thing that I most associate with Woody Allen. I loved your early successful movies.
Right. It's the joke from Stardust Memories that comes up over and over at the beginning, fans rushing up and saying, oh, your early movies were great.
They're
right.
So good.
He's supposed to be Fellini, but he's also supposed to be almost sort of this, I don't know who to describe him as, this burned out poet, kind of romantic, Byronic poet type. Right. I mean, Fellini, I don't think, was known as this, you know, incredibly handsome, dashing guy who swept through Rome, womanizing with everyone in sight.
Yeah,
and that's
maybe
how
Rossellini,
this guy is.
But not so much Fellini.
So this guy, Guido Contini, played by Daniel Day-Lewis, we begin the movie as he's trying to contemplate the concept of his next upcoming movie at a moment that his career seems like he's extremely famous, but it's just about to go into decline because his movies haven't been up to snuff.
Yeah.
And then there's this great fantasy dream sequence. Well, all the songs are fantasies. This is what I wanted to get to, is the way they sell the concept is that every song takes place only in Guido Contini's head. So let's talk about how the songs are handled in the movie.
Well, they're all in Guido's head. You know, it's clearly fantasy. We're not in real life where suddenly everybody put, you know, the people in the office put down their pens and their typewriters and start singing. It's fantasy. It's very clearly fantasy.
And only Guido's fantasy.
Yeah,
right?
And very cinematic. I mean, it's the fantasies of a very image-conscious movie director. They're very spectacular. They're also the fantasies of a man with a high libido, I guess.
Right. So the very first number, which is called Guido's Song, takes place in this kind of empty warehouse space where he's imagining his next movie. And suddenly this parade of women in, you know, basically showgirl outfits come out and start climbing down ladders and appearing in doorways and singing this song at him. And they're going to be all the women that people the movie. Yeah. I think in the stage show, maybe one of the listeners can write in if this isn't true, but I think there was only one man in the stage show. There was the guy who played Guido Contini, who was Raul Julia, I think, in the original.
Mm.
And then all women, you know, so it was this very high concept, you know, a man surrounded by women who were all in a way projections of his fantasy.
Right. Yeah. So these women are incredible actresses. I mean, one thing this movie does not lack is acting star power. We were counting earlier. So basically there's Guido and seven women. That's, you know, the main characters of this movie. And six of the eight of them have Oscars. And since Daniel has two, that's seven Oscars. Kate Hudson was nominated for one. Fergie of Black Eyed Peas is the only one who doesn't have an Oscar yet.
Yeah, Fergie needs to get on that. She must have felt really left out at the reindeer games during the shooting. So even though I think you and I could revisit visually almost every number, the one where Penelope Cruz is almost naked climbing a rope, and the one where Marion Cotillard does a striptease, I don't think we could sing. Could you sing a single song from this movie?
Well, there are two of them that have stuck with me in a way that surprises me. And I think for the most, they are incredibly forgettable. I mean, the minute that the music stops, you've forgotten them. And there are some visual images that remain. But Be Italian, which is a song that Fergie sings representing, I guess, Guido's first stirrings of what, sexuality?
Yeah, she's his
lust.
Id, basically, right? And there is a scene that is straight from Fellini. I think it's in a couple different Fellini movies where he remembers in black and white, in very Fellini-looking kind of 60s-style black and white, this moment when he and a bunch of little boys from his village went to the village prostitute and gave her all these coins that they got together, and she sort of sat down and told them about sex. So that's Fergie's song, basically, and that song turns into Be Italian. I guess that's all you need to know about the facts of life.
Be Italian. And it's a weird song. I mean, it's got maybe four notes that are just kind of repeated, but in a way that's memorable. And, you know, the staging, like all of the songs, is very sexy, very sexual, but you just remember the melody. And then the other one is a song which I think is awful. Kate Hudson plays Stephanie, an American journalist. She writes for Vogue. And
she's always trying to collar Guido for an interview.
Right, or for a drink or for whatever. And she sings this song, Cinema Italiano, which has
Cinema, please.
Cinema Italiano. And it has the worst lyrics. I mean, I'm going to read some. The scenes I love to see from Guido's POV. There's no one else with his unique director's vision. His angles, wide and tight, each moment feels so right. Defines Italian style by only his decision. And I mean, you have to read it in that
staccato
way, because that's in a way because I remember the music, but also otherwise you would just, you know, slash your wrists. It's just terrible prose, but I really remember that song. And also, since Kate Hudson can dance, unlike pretty much all the other actresses who are marvelous, wonderful actresses, but they can't actually dance, so that's the only song that really has kind of movement to it as well.
I guess, yeah, Kate Hudson can move, but I still thought that number was a complete travesty. And then later on reading the notes, I realized that there was a reason that it stuck out. That was actually written for the movie. There were three numbers that were written for the movie by Maury Yeston, who wrote the song, the music and lyrics for the show, because I guess he needed further exposition and he wanted something for that character to do. So that Cinema Italiano was one. But another one is what I think is the most successful number in the whole movie, which is Marion Cotillard's striptease number. Let's talk about that. So Marion Cotillard, who, if you don't know, just won recently an Oscar for playing Edith Piaf.
Right, in La Vie en Rose.
And is fantastic, I think, in this movie, as she was in La Vie en Rose. Like, she's really the next big thing, right?
Absolutely.
She plays Guido Contini's wife, his long-suffering wife, who he's now cheated on countless times with every leading lady that he's had.
And she
since.
Was once his
and
leading
she was once his leading lady. Yeah. So she has a couple of great numbers, one of which was in the original stage show called My Husband Makes Movies, which is actually in her imagination. I think it's possibly the only number that doesn't take place in Guido's imagination that we know of.
That's right.
When she's introduced to some of his cinema friends, and, you know, she's a little bit in the hobnobbing world that she's left out of all the time, and she wanders off and sort of fantasizes and dreams about their broken marriage. That's a really nice number. But the one that she really kills in is her striptease number. What's that one called? Take It All, right?
No, it's amazing. The song is absolutely forgettable, but she is... I mean, I have never seen a striptease that seemed more... that was more believable. I mean, it was very sexy, but it also was very violent. I mean, people were pulling clothes off her. When you think of what a striptease is, especially when it involves the men in the audience, it actually is about being, you know, undressed by these voyeurs. Well, that seems obvious, but it's never felt more visceral than when
and
she
menacing,
did it. Yeah,
right.
Absolutely.
And somehow she managed to make it advance the story, which this movie takes some doing because the story is utterly ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, we kind of still haven't gotten to the central paradox of this movie, which is that it is utterly ridiculous. The music is totally unmemorable. It has so many chunks of cheese falling off of it right and left.
Totally.
And yet, I found it thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it. I mean, I could sit here and, you know, criticize it for hours and hours, but I had a real fun time for 2 hours. And it is lovely to look at these great actresses. I mean, some of them are very misused. Nicole Kidman plays Guido's muse, whatever that means. We never really find out.
She's sort of supposed to be like Anita Ekberg in the Fellini movies, right?
Yeah,
she looks
yeah.
like Anita Ekberg from La Dolce Vita.
And she has a similar, she's Claudia Jensen or something like that. And she just does nothing. I mean, she has a song, of course, which I can't remember what it is or what it does. But she, you know, she kind of strolls through Rome with him, or I could think it's Rome. Maybe it's the town that the seaside town that he runs to. But it's really just a matter of her looking perfect. And she does look perfect. There's a scene where he kind of does a film test, whatever we call that, of her. And she, yes, she looks perfect, but completely and utterly two-dimensional. We don't know anything about her except that she's Guido's muse. That's it and that's all. But the rest of them, they look great. I mean, it, one of the things that's tragic about this movie, I think, is that we have some of the great bosoms of our time. I mean, and really displayed. I mean, this movie, Rob Marshall, the director, deserves praise for nothing else. It's for how, I mean, the man knows something about corsets. I mean, Judi Dench, who, you know, she's hot. I'm not taking anything away from her, but she's in her 70s. And she looks amazing. She has a scene where...
It's true. When you think of Judi Dench, I mean, you don't think of her figure, right? But this movie really shows it off.
She shows them off to advantage. Exactly. She's got an amazing figure. Penelope Cruz, astonishing. Marion Cotillard also looks great.
We should mention also that even though Marion Cotillard does a striptease, the one who really gets up close and personal is Penelope Cruz.
Absolutely.
So if she floats your boat, you should so go to this movie.
And there's a lot of floating going on. But so we've got the great racks of our time on display, and yet who's going to see this movie? It's going to be straight women and gay men. I mean, there's never been a greater waste of boobs in cinema history. It's just tragic. So I suppose you're right. We haven't actually gotten to what happens in the film. Basically, Guido's stuck and he's being tortured by women, but really is his wife and his mistress, who's played by Penelope Cruz, and like, is there anything else?
There's like writer's block, basically.
Writer's block,
I mean, it's pretty hard to make a musical about writer's block at all interesting, but obviously if anyone can make that seem deep and meaningful, it's Daniel Day-Lewis.
Right.
Who almost brings this excess. I was reading in the notes again that he learned Italian for this part, and he doesn't even speak Italian. He speaks with an Italian accent in old Hollywood movie style, right? Like,
right.
I am speaking Italian because I have an accent.
Which is kind of...
But he learned Italian for the freaking movie.
It's ridiculous, though, because he does have this Italian accent, and Sophia Loren, Oscar winner Sophia Loren, comes in there playing his mother, and he has much more of an accent than she does. I mean, it's just kind of silly. But I do like the kind of pan-Europeanness of it. I mean, we've got Fergie and Kate Hudson, who are American, Judi Dench, who's English, although I don't know what she's supposed to be. She has her song is about the Folie Bergère.
I think she's supposed to be British, right?
Okay.
British, but with a history of making costumes for the Folie Bergère.
We've got Penelope Cruz, who's Spanish, Marion Cotillard is French, I mean, I don't know. Oh, well, Nicole Kidman's Australia. I mean, it is this fantastic international, you know, global movie. It's just sort of, I'm not quite sure what it's in the purpose, in the, I'm not sure what it's all about or what it's all for.
Right. I mean, it seems like the number of people who are actually theater nerds who are going to be drawn to see it is so small, but then the star power is going to bring in a few more. You're right. It's not really clear who this movie is being marketed to. And for my money, I mean, Chicago was a huge surprise success, right?
Yep.
It won all these Oscars, and people really loved it. It was a big hit.
Yep.
And that really surprised me at the time because I thought it really had that problem, the problem of stage-to-screen transition that just feels like a dead fish flopping around on screen. I think this movie has that less, but I think that's just because of the performances. I mean, Catherine Zeta-Jones is a bit of a dead, flopping fish in that movie.
Yeah.
As is, Renee Zellweger, please.
Oh, I forgot that she was in it. I mean, Queen Latifah was big and bomb, and I guess it had Richard Gere. I mean, Richard Gere was the male equivalent for the, you know, the estrogen benefit. But
the only thing I remember about all of Chicago is John C. Reilly singing Mr. Cellophane, because it's a great song and a great performance. And that was a moment that I actually felt like I was watching a stage show. The rest of it felt like, you know how Rob Marshall loves to move his camera around to prove that it's not a stage, right? Yeah. So his only way of doing it is to frame a very boring shot of a stage and then start wildly waggling the camera around to remind you that it's cinema.
Right.
And so it's all just sort of disorienting.
And dizzy-making. The only thing I remember from Chicago is Queen Latifah's décolletage, so I suppose we also established that Rob Marshall is really good at framing breasts.
So at least these movies found one breast appreciator in their
audience. I'm sure there must be more, possibly.
Okay, so I want to get back to that, but let's just stop for one quick word from our sponsor, who, as regular listeners know, is Audible.com, the leading purveyor of audiobooks on the web with over 60,000 titles. And we have a recommendation for this week, which I think is nicely thematically related, or at least obscurely related to our movie. Actually, we went crazy on Audible. Like, does Sophia Loren have a memoir? Because she plays, we didn't mention Guido Contini's mother in this movie. I thought she might have a juicy memoir, but apparently she had a long, happy marriage and has nothing to write about.
But at least on Audible.
But we did find Judi Dench, who we didn't mention much in the movie, but I think is one of the high points of the movie, who has several things on Audible that she reads aloud, including
The House of Pooh, which apparently she reads with Stephen Fry and Michael Williams, who was her husband of many, many years. Unfortunately, he died some years ago. But they were a very sweet couple that often acted together. And I guess you can only imagine that it would get better with Stephen Fry in the mix.
So, yeah, I'm wondering now who's who. Like, I imagine Stephen Fry is probably Pooh. There's not really any women in the world of Pooh, so I don't know who Judi Dench is. Maybe she's the narratrix.
Yeah, maybe she, yes, exactly.
And then Michael Williams is Piglet or something, but it's out there to explore.
Yeah, he was a very, very sweet guy, so I could really see him with Pooh.
He was a theater actor
as
well? Yes,
they, as I said, they often acted together, did a lot of Shakespeare together, and then also some sort of silly TV as well. They were a very lovely couple.
See, what would I do without you and your theater nerd knowledge? It's great. So the place to sign up for that is on our page, which is www.audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. And if you go there, you can sign up for a free audiobook, including the Winnie the Pooh one, which you get to keep even if you don't decide to stay with your membership. So back to Nine.
Dana, would you say, if you were a fan of, you know, Italian neorealism, is this a kind of a continuation of that genre? Is it an homage to all of that?
Well, I don't know if you'd call Fellini. Certainly, 8.5 is not neorealism because it's too fantastical. But yeah, if you're a aficionado of Italian art cinema, right? Yeah. Would there be anything in this for you? It seems like the references are so shallow that it wouldn't really amount to very much. I mean, if you like Kate Hudson's character, if you love cinema italiano as a kind of style statement, which is what her song is about skinny ties.
Skinny ties.
Then there's plenty of that. I mean, the style is incredible. And there's a scene where he's driving by the Forum at the beginning in his little, is it like a yellow roadster or something?
Yeah, it's a great car.
And there's some really excellent style in that sense. But cinematically, this movie is about as uninteresting as it gets, right? I mean, everything that's interesting in it has to do with the stage and with theater. So the fact that there's a little bit of dressing around the sides that vaguely hints at 60s Italian cinema is not that interesting.
Yeah. Would you recommend this movie?
You know, I think I would, but it would depend on who was asking me. I mean, I'm probably going to write a review that's more about celebrity and about the weird interaction of the Oscars. It's like the statuettes. It's like seven statuettes, you know, acting in a movie.
Yeah.
Than about the actual quality of the movie. But I guess I would say if any of these actors, like I say, floats your boat, I mean, if any of these people are someone that you just like to follow their career and they captivate you on screen, God knows there's plenty of somebody's got to captivate you out of that lineup, then I would say you should see it then.
And I would say anybody who's a fan of acting. I mean, Marion Cotillard really takes what is a kind of, they're all very superficial, very undeveloped roles. And also quite cliche, and yet she takes the, you know, the wronged wife, and really, she does break your heart. And if you can achieve that in the middle of this film, it's an even greater achievement, I think.
No, I think you're right. And there's still a lot of people who don't know who Marion Cotillard is. I mean, I know some people who are big movie fans who, for whatever reason, didn't see La Vie en Rose, and they haven't gotten yet the sensation that is Marion Cotillard. Yeah. So I would send them to this for sure.
For sure.
All right, June, well, thank you for joining me for Nine.
Thank you.
And thanks for coming in for this Slate spoiler special. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but. neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.